You could never say, oh, let's do the easy thing. You know, if we were, you know, organising a race that year, you know, it was never okay to just say, oh, well, let's just do this and, it'll be a bit easier. It always had to be the best. You know, he lived what he believed in. And I think maybe that's the thing that people really respect in him and aspire to and, you know, really recognise as something... Yeah, really impressive, you know, that he genuinely lived what he believed.
You are listening to Explore by the Cycling Podcast in association with Rafa. Adventure starts anywhere.
Hannah, you seem to be half wheeling me a bit here.
Well, the thing I'm slightly concerned about, Lionel, is if you want that slice of cake when we get to the cafe, you have to start and go a bit faster than this.
Are you saying I'm going too slowly?
Maybe.
That was a very theatrical look down at your handlebar computer there.
Science in sport, fueled by science.
Hello and welcome to Explore by the Cycling Podcast. My name's Lionel Burney and I'm with Hannah Troop. Hello, Hannah.
Hello, Lionel.
How are you doing?
I'm good, thank you. Very good. I've just got back yesterday from the cycling mecca of Europe, which is known as Girona. And it was actually quite a lot warmer there than what it is here, unfortunately.
Have you been training for the Rafa Festive 500? Is that what you've been doing?
I wish I had the luxury to be able to go off and cycle for 5 days in Girona to just train for the Festive 500, but unfortunately not.
Oh, well, the Festive 500 gets underway on Christmas Eve, and the challenge is to ride 500 kilometres between then and New Year's Eve, and you're still committed to it.
100% committed. I'm always 100% committed, and I'm actually rallying around getting more friends to come and try and cycle with me between those periods, which is quite a nice thing to do. And I think that you're going to come along at some point, aren't you, and go for a cycle as well, Lionel?
I have almost set that in stone. Yes, I will. I'll join you for a ride if you're coming out of London. I'll definitely join you for a ride.
I've organised it all with Simon, the photographer. You're 100% committed anyway.
I am now. Well, this episode of Explore is very much an episode of two halves. In the first half, we'll be talking to Anna Haslock, who is one of the organisers of the Transcontinental Race and was the partner of the late Mike Horn, who was killed while riding the Indian Pacific Wheel Race in March 2017. I went up to the National Cycle Museum in Llandrinod, Wales, in Mid Wales to meet Anna, and that will form the first part of this episode. And in part two, we'll talk to the current round the world record holders, both of whom are from Scotland: Mark Beaumont, the quickest man to ride around the world, and Jenny Graham, who recently broke the record, or set the record, for the quickest woman to cycle round the world. I nearly said at the start, Hannah, that this is the final episode of the debut season of Explore, but it's not, because we'll be back on New Year's Day, January the 1st, with a special 7th episode, a bonus. Because we're good like that, aren't we?
Yeah, we are. And what better way to start a new year than with a bit of inspiration from another episode of Explore? I can't think of any better way.
I can't. And by then, maybe the goal for 2019 will have been set for me by either the listeners or by you, Hannah. What will I be doing on the bike in 2019? Who knows? It's still up for grabs. Anyone who wants to suggest something can do so. Email us, contact@thecyclingpodcast.com, or send us a message on Twitter @cycling_podcast. And obviously, I have the right of veto. I can pick and choose from the list, but... I'm not going to ride around the world, that's for sure.
The parameters of the challenge are quite narrow, aren't they, Lionel?
Extremely narrow. Extremely narrow. But thank you for that, Hannah. And thank you to our regular sponsors, Rafa and Science in Sport. Their support has enabled us to get this series of Explore off the ground, and as has the support of The Economist, who have supported this series of Explore. The magazine is about far more than just economics and finance. It covers a range of subjects, from politics and business to science, technology, the arts and the environment. The Economist helps readers prepare for what is going on in the world around them, and in today's dynamic world, facts matter more than ever. If you're in the UK and you'd like to get a free print copy of The Economist, you can text the word cycle, C-Y-C-L-E, to 78070. Hannah, you've been reading The Economist of late. What caught your eye in the magazine?
Yeah, so one of the articles that caught my eye this week is called A Murky Business under the heading Stormzynomics. So for those of you who aren't familiar, Stormzy is a rapper from the south of London, and they said that he's actually challenging the music business. Now, this was quite interesting to me because I think that the way that the media landscape in general, how it's changed over the years, with the introduction of the internet and with social media, it's completely changed the landscape. And so it's quite interesting to see that obviously with the music industry, that is also very much changing as well. And so they kind of say that there's now a savvier generation of musicians whom the industry likes to call artist entrepreneurs. And these people are basically building their own brands through their social media and no longer relying on the labels from the merchandising deals that they have with their labels. So it's quite interesting how this kind of this change is happening, and this evolution of media and music is happening. And I guess it's kind of also something that we've seen with podcasts as well. So it's a really interesting topic that I've enjoyed reading up on.
It is indeed. And if you'd like to get a free print copy of The Economist delivered to your door, text the word cycle to 78070. The first part of this episode is my conversation with Anna Haslock, who is one of the organisers of the Transcontinental Race and was the partner of the late Mike Hall, who was killed in a bikepacking race in Australia. And I wanted to speak to Anna because Mike Hall's influence has really been present throughout the whole of this series. We began with an episode that focused on the Transcontinental Race, and so we're kind of coming full circle. A lot of people have talked about the influence that Mike Hall had on them, and I wanted to get a sense of who Mike Hall was and what it was about him that inspired people. And so I arranged to meet Anna at the National Cycle Museum. Felt like an appropriate place to meet, not least because it's quite close to where she lives. And we went in, we were given a very warm welcome, and we sat down to talk about how Mike Hall saw this whole sport of bikepacking. So Anna, who are we joined with here?
So this is my parents' dog, Foxy, is visiting. So she's here with me today.
I suppose I should ask you whereabouts we are.
We're at the National Cycle Museum in Llandrindod Wells. I was just saying, a bit of a shame to say that this is the first time I've ever been, but it's amazing. It's a treasure trove of bikes that everybody should come to, shouldn't they, really? It's incredible.
It's a combination of time warp and museum, I would say. There's some real old bikes in here. There's some very unusual bikes. There's a tricycle from the 1930s there, children's tricycle. There's some very unusual shapes of frames. It doesn't feel like a museum that has an awful lot of through traffic, perhaps, but definitely worth a visit if you're in the middle of Wales and passing by. You say you're slightly ashamed you didn't know the extent of the museum, but I gather you grew up here.
Yes, yeah. So my parents moved here when I was one and went to school here and, moved away when I was 18 to go to art college. But apart from that, and then moved back maybe 5 years ago now. So, yeah, spent most of my life in Mid Wales.
And are you a cyclist yourself?
I am, yes. I would say before meeting Mike, I just thought of a bike as a means of getting about, really. I thought there were great ways of getting about, but didn't have a particularly great bike. I think Mike was a bit ashamed of my bike when we first met. And but since meeting Mike, obviously cycling's become a massive part of my life, and I'm much more interested in it now, and you know, go out most days on my bike to keep fit and get around. And
so how did you meet Mike? It wasn't cycling that brought you together?
No, we met through mutual friends. They lived with Mike in Cardiff. They shared a place together. They actually, when Mike finished the Around the World event in 2012, I didn't know him then, and they invited me down to London. They went down to London to see him arrive, and they invited me down. And they were like, oh, yeah, this friend of ours has done this round the world thing. He's finishing in London. You want to come down? And I was like, oh, yeah, I'll come down if I'm free. And it just didn't work out. I didn't go. And obviously they went and saw him arrive and everything. And it was all in the papers, and that passed me by completely. and then we met... I don't know. We met in at the end of 2013, just me visiting them at their place, really. So, yeah, that's how we met.
So when you met Mike, I mean, what did you make of the extent of the cycling he did? I mean, he wasn't just commuting to work. He was someone who was riding across the globe.
I was incredibly impressed, yeah. You know, I'd never met anybody who did... I mean, our mutual friend Richard is a passionate cyclist and cycles long distances, but... You know, I obviously never met anyone who cycled around the world before. Yeah, I was very impressed, but also what everybody says about Mike, you know, he's a very humble guy, and, he just came across as just... Well, he was a normal guy. Of course he was. These incredible feats that he'd done, I guess, in a way, they were quite hard to kind of... what's the word? Kind of... match the guy with the things that he'd done, and so yeah, I guess in a way he was, you know, Mike, the guy who was friends with my friends, who, you know, we got on really well, and you know, we went out and things, and then it was a bit of a disconnect maybe for a while between that guy and the guy who did these amazing cycling feats and did these incredible races. But you know, the longer we spent together and the more when, you know, we lived together and everything, obviously that just blurs into one then. And you know, and I was quite involved in his preparation, and, you know, of course I was in before the big event. So then it all just becomes one, and it's normal then.
So when you first met him, I mean, did you ask why, what it was that drove him to want to do this?
Yeah, I guess so. I think with Mike, he always needed to be pushing himself. He always needed a goal. He always needed something to be working towards, something to stretch himself. I think, you know, he's an incredibly intelligent person. And I think kind of even being an aeronautical engineer was a bit boring, was a bit too easy. And... you know, he wasn't, he would never have said that, you know, wasn't arrogant about that, but it just wasn't enough to push, you know, for him to, he needed more stuff to push himself and to stretch himself and to see what he was capable of. And I guess the more he did that stuff, like, for example, around the world event, the more, you know, like, how can you top that? What's the next thing you do? You know, I think, was it 2015 or something? He was interested in a expedition to the South Pole that was going to take 6 months. I don't know how he was going to fit that in with everything else he did, but, you know, so he was always looking for just things that most people wouldn't even consider.
How did you feel about that, knowing that the itch would never be scratched almost?
Yeah, that was a tricky thing. Yeah, it's tricky for him. It's a tricky thing for everybody. You know, he always had to be pushing. He always had to be working for something new. And yeah, that sometimes made life a bit tricky because, you know, you've also got to try and fit in the normal stuff like family and, you know, and those things, and that they're kind of hard to fit in as well as all these big adventures. And so that was sometimes difficult. Yeah.
And what was it about unsupported cycling? Because I mean, there are some epic supported events where a team gets together and gives the rider backup on the road. I'm thinking of the Race Across America, for example, or even Mark Beaumont, you know, breaking the round the world record. But this subgenre of unsupported cycling, which has really experienced a boom in probably the last 6, 7, 8 years, what was it about that drew him, do you think?
A mixture of things, I think. Partly, I guess, his personality type. He's maybe a bit of a loner. You know, he's definitely a very self-sufficient person. So that way of doing things suited him, and obviously he recognised that there's obviously a lot of other people that would suit. And the other side of that, the other sort of element of that is doing something with a massive team is incredibly expensive and just puts it outside of the reach of most people. So doing something yourself, self-supported, you are just relying on yourself. And the you know, the big thing around the TCR for both of us was it had to be democratic. It had to be achievable for as many people as we could make it. So it had to be not too expensive. So, you know, we've always said, you know, you should be able to do the TCR on a fairly minimal budget. You know, you don't need a new bike. You don't need all this new kit. I mean, obviously people like that, and there's no problem with that either. But the idea is that you don't need it. And that, you know, you can rely on yourself, and it's a test of a human's ability to get from point A to point B on a bike.
So tell me about the kind of the birth of the TCR then. I mean, Mike had obviously done a lot of similar events, was very good at this discipline of cycling, but what was it that made him want to create an event of his own?
I think, I'm not sure exactly where that would have come from, but I know that when he was doing the round the world race, you know, himself, the riders of it, there was a few problems with the organisation and stuff as it when it was starting, and so the riders had to get involved with making sure it happened. So he was quite he was instrumental in that. You know, he had a big part in that. He's a leader. He was a leader. So you know, if he was going to do something, he was going to do it well, and he got other people to do it well, you know. So probably that kind of experience showed him what was possible, and that, you know, maybe he was capable. And then as he set off around the world, the first leg basically was, you know, from London to Istanbul. That was his first leg. So he sort of did the TCR he did the TCR as the first leg of his race. And so, you know, as he was doing it, he was thinking, you know, actually this is like an achievable thing that people could do in a couple of weeks in their holidays. You know, this is like a mini adventure. You don't need to be able to take off however many months it's going to take to cycle around the world. You can have, you know, but you can have an achievable version in your 2 weeks off work.
So how long have you also been involved in the running of it?
So I sort of formally got more involved in 2014. I was running a printing business at the time, from a little kind of garage. And you know, he's very interested in what I was doing, and we were interested in how we could sort of combine the things that we were doing and work together more. And so that's where the sort of birth of the printing the caps came from. We hand print them with sort of antique letterpress blocks, wooden ones. And so that's where that came from. We started doing that in 2014.
How does that work? Because everyone gets a numbered cap, but how does the numbering work? I guess James Hayden was one because he was the defending champion, but how do the rest of the numbers sort themselves out?
So we say, I think it's between 1 and 10, or first and 10th place. If they're going to race again, we'll try and give them their number. If you've raced before, so you're a veteran, obviously, unless your number competes with a previous winner, we'll try and give you your number back. And apart from that, it's just a lottery. Yeah.
But it's part of a kind of a branding and an image that has very quickly established itself. I mean, you know, it does hark back to the sort of the origins of the yellow jersey in a way. It's just the same kind of thought process that's gone into it, I guess.
Yeah. Mike, you know, the TCR is an attempt to kind of rekindle the, I suppose it's probably quite romanticised version of the history and the kind of passion that that was around the Tour de France in the early years, and you know, the self-sufficiency of the Tour de France in the early years. So that was the reason that, you know, the TCR started, and yeah, it's important to us to try and maintain that, and yeah,
as well as the self-sufficiency, but also the self-policing, the fact that the rules are very, the real brevity to the rules, isn't there? It's basically act within the spirit of the unwritten rules, almost.
Yeah, yes, and that made more sense when Mike was the race director, because you know, he everybody respects Mike's what he's done, what he's proven he can do. He's proven his sort of commitment to self-sufficiency in his races. It was so important to him that nobody could sort of raise any questions about his self-sufficiency on his racing. So that it was easier in a way when he was race director with that, because I think there was a kind of implicit kind of understanding. I hope that's in an extent transferred to me, because you know, I knew Mike intimately, and I knew it's, you know, it's really important to me that we keep that kind of level of honesty and trust and everything alive. So I hope that kind of transfers, but I feel it's quite important that we keep talking about that, and maybe do our best to kind of explain it a bit more in the future, to make sure we keep that level of, because it is self-policed, yeah, and we need people to be honest and to be doing this race because they believe in the rules and they believe in the spirit of the race. There's plenty of other things for people to do if that's not for them.
So in brief, I mean, the rules are basically you set off with your bike and what you can carry, and you can't arrange for somebody to meet you in Austria with a load of supplies. You can only take what you can find en route, what you can buy en route. You're alone. It's you from point A to point B as far as is possible.
Yeah, you need to think of the race as if you were doing it on your own. The wonderful thing about the TCR is that you're not, and not only are you racing other races, but you're all in it together. And that's, you know, that's definitely what a lot of the most of the riders really enjoy and sort of thrive on when they're racing. You know, you can see this camaraderie building, and at the, you know, the party at the end, you know, this amazing respect and friendship between all these people who've never met before, you know, and
because they have a shared experience, albeit possibly on slightly different routes.
Yeah, they've battled this, you know, beast of a race from point A to point B, and they've had completely different experiences in some way, but because of their different routes, but they share the same experience of sort of struggling against this race, and you know, that has all these constraints that they've got to kind of try and meet, and yeah, so they all feel a real camaraderie around that. I think you asked me something before that I was trying to... I can't remember what I was saying. What was the question before that?
That's a very good question.
We've deviated.
Well, the conversation has deviated on, because we've just got point A to point B to get to. We can go any route we like, as long as we meet the checkpoints on the way. Why did the start move from London to Hellersbergen in Belgium a few years ago? That's always intrigued me.
Okay. Yeah, it's tricky to start in the UK because of the legality of racing in the UK. I think in the early years it was pretty punk, it was pretty low key. As the interest in the race grew, we realised we can't be doing things like that. So we moved to Gerardsbergen, which had been the first control point, I think, in the first race. And so we went over and met with the guys from the town. They were really, really keen, and they came up with all these amazing ideas of how, you know, we could create this like iconic start. They were just really helpful and kind. And
because it basically kicks off with the Mur, doesn't it?
Yes, yeah. So this year, TCR number six, we couldn't have the flames. We couldn't have the flaming torches, which was such a shame. But the summer had been so dry. The day before the race, the Belgian government brought in a law saying we couldn't have naked flames. You know, there just couldn't be naked flames. So it was the day before. It was very bad timing, really. But and it did actually rain that day as well. We were kind of thinking, oh, maybe we'll get it. But, you know. That's fair enough. It's a good reason.
So flames by the side of the road as a, to give the official start.
Yeah, so flame torches all the way. So all the people who'd come to watch the start would set off walking up the Muir as the riders did a kind of neutralised loop around the town, and then as the audience were kind of in place with these flaming torches, that's when the race would start in the square. So the first kind of climb of the Muir is a race, and with just all these amazing torches, and I always used to be in the vehicle, so I always used to have to, and I'd always be in the back, so I was kind of behind it all. And in TCR number five, I got to not be in one of the vehicles, and I got to stand on the Muir and really soak in the atmosphere, and it was just incredible. Yeah, I was, you know, just this excitement and how magical it looked in the dark with all these torches, and every, you know, the riders so excited about what they're about to set off and do, and all their friends and family so excited to see them. It was very moving. Yeah.
So just back to Mike and the stature that he, I guess didn't seek, but kind of grew into in this this portion of cycle sport. I mean, it can't just be because he was good at it. I mean, there must have been something else, because I never met him, haven't spoken to him. I've spoken to people who knew him, but he's almost revered. I mean, has a kind of almost iconic status. And I'm kind of intrigued what it was about his personality that meant that people kind of loved him so much.
I think it's just this kind of humble guy who could so easily have been so arrogant, you know, who had so much going for him in terms of intelligence and this passion for justice and honesty, so much determination to see things through, to make things, you know, like, you could never say, oh, let's do the easy thing. You know, if we were, you know, organising a race that year, you know, it was never okay to just say, oh, well, let's just do this and, it'll be a bit easier. It always had to be the best, and he was always pushing himself to be the best. And, you know, he lived what he believed in. And I think maybe that's the thing that people really respecting him and aspire to, and, you know, really recognise as something, yeah, really impressive, you know, that he genuinely lived what he believed.
Rafa, adventure starts anywhere.
Thank you very much to Rafa for sponsoring this series of Explore, and indeed the cycling podcast all year round. If you're listening to this before Christmas and need a gift for a fellow cyclist, perhaps a 12-month membership of the Rafa Cycling Club would fit the bill. Or if you're listening to this after Christmas, maybe you want to give yourself the gift of cycling with a global community of passionate road riders. The club is accessible to everyone, and cyclists of all abilities are welcome to join. Membership includes organised rides and events, the opportunity to buy the Rafa Cycling Club kit, complimentary coffee at Rafa's clubhouses in cities around the world, and lots more. So if that sounds like the sort of thing for you, go to rafa.cc and sign up as a Rafa Cycling Club member today. So tell me about the Indian Pacific Wheel Race in March 2017, because, I mean, it's a long event. It was a new event to ride across Australia the first year. Was it a case that as soon as somebody said there's now an event across Australia, Mike was like, well, I've got to be there, I've got to do it?
He knew Jesse. He'd known of Jesse for a while. I think they'd met. if not, they'd been in touch and stuff, so they knew each other. And so I think as soon as Jesse Carson, you know, started a race, Mike was interested, and Jesse was really keen to get the big names on the first event. So he was really keen to get Mike there, he was really keen to get Christoph there, and I think Mike knew, Christoph knew, everyone knew that everybody wanted to see Mike and Christoph race. So yeah, you know, it seemed perfect, you know, it seemed like the perfect, yeah, perfect opportunity. So I don't think he could have let that one go.
Even though he would have been in the midst of organising the TCR that would set off a few months later, I mean, packing his schedule pretty tightly.
Yeah. Yeah, he did, but he just didn't let stuff like that stop him. If, you know, basically, if he was going to do something, he was going to do it well, and he just made sure he did things, you know. So yeah, it's I think in 2015 we tried a year without Mike racing a race while we organised the TCR, and to me it seemed like, oh, that's, you know, this is a sensible thing, you know, and it'll allow us to kind of fit in normal life and all these other things. But I've said it before, you know, Mike needed to race himself, and it was a bad idea for him to have a year off racing. So we both realised that.
Did it make him cranky, the fact that he didn't have anything on the calendar to do?
Yeah, I think he needed to be training, he needed to be working towards something. That made things difficult for him, and also he really worried that he was losing his relevance, you know, that why would people respect him as a race director if he wasn't racing races, you know? And that really concerned him. So it was really important to him to be the race director of the TCR, that people respected what he was doing on a bike himself.
And how did you feel, I mean, when he was going off to Australia to take part, and talk me through, you know, how you learned that he'd been killed?
He set off. I'd been helping him with the arrangements to go out as much as I could. We were working on we actually did a sewing project, building this kind of like roll mat sleeping bag thing that he'd designed, and so we built that and sewed that all together before he went. So yeah, he was excited about going, maybe slightly more more excited, but also more not nervous, but the big expectation and you know, the obviously pressure to beat Christoph, or at least give Christoph a real good run for his money, you know, that was an added element of the kind of stuff he needed, you know, that was looking for. So, you know, it wasn't like that it was a problem for Mike, all of that stuff. It was a good thing. It's exciting and nerve-wracking, I suppose. So yeah, he set off and everything, you know. Of course, we did actually talk about what might happen if there was an accident this time, which we'd never spoken of before, and we just actually ended up talking about it just because of money things, really. We had a money situation we needed to concern ourselves about, and so we just ended up talking about it for that, because we'd never ever spoken about that before. And he just happened to say, you know, I hope that if anything ever does happen to me, that the race continues, you know. Just, it's a bit of a throwaway comment, really. But yeah, obviously that the worst that could ever happened, and I found out when his brother phoned me at 5 a.m. and 5 a.m. phone calls never good, is it? So that's how I found out.
Would you like to take a break?
Yeah, I think so.
So So what do you now know about the circumstances of what happened? Because you went to the inquest in Australia with Mike's mum, didn't you? I've read the kind of press coverage of that. We're still waiting for a verdict from the coroner, but I've read some quotes from you. You're not terribly happy with the police investigation into the incident. Also read a very moving interview with Mike's mum where she forgives the driver who hit Mike. And I suppose two-part question, really. One, what were you unhappy about with regard to the police investigation?
There's limited stuff I can say because we're sort of in the midst of the inquest still, and the last thing I want to do is sort of jeopardise anything in any way. But I can say, obviously, what I've said before, which is... the police investigation was not conducted to the standard that it should have been. I've spent a lot of time researching that now, and I'm providing all the details to the coroner as to exactly what, in my opinion, should have been done better. And, you know, I don't know what can be done about that, but I'm providing all those details to the coroner. For me... You know, this is two things. One is that Mike deserves justice, and Mike deserves the truth, and I need the truth and justice to deal with this this thing. And the second thing is, it's bigger than Mike, and it's bigger than Mike's collision. It's about cycling, and it's about how safe or not it is to cycle on roads, and it needs to be safer. This is a big problem, international problem. To me, if anything good can come of this, you know, with Mike's profile, with the racist profile, if we can make riding on roads safer for cyclists, then that, you know, that can only be a good thing. This is a horrible thing to have happened, and nothing will make it okay. But if I can do that, then something good can have come from it, I think. And that's what I need to come from this. You know, Mike's mum needs to forgive the driver, and I completely respect that. You know, that's what she needs to do. And that doesn't work for me, but I completely respect that's what she needs.
In terms of what events like this kind of push people to do and somebody's attitude to risk, everyone has different attitude to risk. I was struck by Rupert Guinness saying that in the Indian Pacific wheel race, you know, he's on highways where they have the road trains, obviously, in Australia. Part of the TCR goes through what I gather are quite sketchy parts of, you know, Romania, for example, where road conditions are probably not really suitable for cyclists. And yet the events put the riders into those spaces. It is a matter of their choice, but it's a choice that's being kind of led towards because of the nature of the events. Yeah. I guess, what was Mike's attitude to risk? I mean, did he have red lines about how long he'd ride, how much sleep he would have, you know, what conditions he would call it a day in? I mean, did you ever talk about that?
I guess so. You can see it actually from his social media activity during the Indian Pacific Wheel Race. You can see him talking about he's actually having problems with his vision on that race. He's getting supposed to be getting some specialist glasses, and they didn't arrive in time or something, and so he went out without these sort of specialist sunglasses that he needed. Obviously, you know, the sun is particularly bright in Australia. He needed something. I think he went out with just a pair of old aviator shades, you know, that weren't ideal, and maybe kept falling off or whatever. So at the start of the race, he was not wearing his sunglasses enough, and he was struggling with his eyesight. And a friend of ours is an optician, and she cottoned on to what was probably the problem and sent him a message saying, you know, you just need to be wearing your sunglasses more. You're straining your eyes in the day, and that's causing you vision problems at night. So you can see from his social media that he was struggling with his vision problems at night, and that was meaning he was stopping more. So, and you can also see that he regularly communicated about problems on the road that he was experiencing, so that people further back in the race could be warned. He said, I think at one stage, no, this is getting silly, I'm going to stop. Obviously, he was feeling unsafe on the road that day. Yeah, so as a racer, he knew that a race is just a race and your life is your life. And, you know, there's no comparison. So he was very careful and very responsible about his own safety. And then as a race director, of course, he felt that much more keenly. And part of the reason that, or a large reason that the transcontinental race is not a set route, is so that riders can be constantly assessing the safety of their route and making decisions about their safety. And so if there is a, you know, you cannot know what all roads are going to be like across Europe from sitting at home doing your research on the computer. You know, you can do a lot of research and you can learn a great deal, but you cannot possibly know what a road's going to be like at different times of the day. And so not having a set route allows our racers to be making risk assessments on the route, and they are the best people to know where their red lines are, where their safety concerns are, and to make decisions accordingly. And, you know, we go on and on and on about it in the race manual that's what they need to be doing, and that's what we rely on them to be doing. You know, it's not like we don't make mistakes. You know, we obviously that year in Romania was pretty sketchy. Me and Mike had been to Romania to scope out, do a recce there. We had not experienced the same kind of things that riders were telling us about on the roads there in Romania. That was a real shock to us. And so, you know, it's made us, be a lot more. We've learnt from that. And
The giving the riders a choice to choose their own route, I completely get that. You give, because different riders might arrive at different points, different times of day. Initially, when you were saying that, I was thinking, is this a cop out on the part of the organisers? Because you can kind of say, well, not our responsibility. When you're out there, you can go any way you want. I was talking to Adrian O'Sullivan from Transatlantic Way, and he taken a choice to probably, he thinks it's a very key distinction. He calls his event a ride, not a race. But in the course of our conversation, he also admitted that as soon as you say, right, the start is here and the finish is there, some people will treat it as a race anyway. So I'm just wondering where you're kind of, you know, how you feel with the transcontinental, because obviously it's continuing on. It seems to be going from strength to strength. It's getting more and more, certainly more and more kind of coverage. It's getting more on the radar of people, you know, more broadly in the cycling industry. So I guess this whole movement, this bike packing, bike racing movement, is reaching a sort of crossroads. And I wonder how you where do you feel that it currently is, and what do you think the next stage will be?
Yeah. Mike said very passionately and determinedly that he was making a race. So he wanted the TCR to be a race, and so I don't think we'll ever turn it into anything else. The year that TCR number 5, the year that he'd sort of designed and we'd started together, and then obviously he wasn't there to see it through, my initial reaction was to turn it into a ride, a memorial ride. I just felt completely terrified. And, you know, but, you know, people around me said, you know, is this actually what, you know, what we were doing with Mike? That's not what we were doing. We were making a race. And if we're going to make a race, you know, we've either got to make the race or not. So so we stuck with it, and we, you know, it is a race. And we just have to work hard to make it as safe as we can. I don't... I don't see it as a sort of cop out to be saying that we don't set a route. I think it's really important if it's, because it's a self-supported race. I think it's really, really important that riders are designing their own route and making decisions about their own route, knowing who they are, you know, because it's not just about safety. It's also about, you know, are you a climber, or do you know, tap out the miles on the straight? You know, what works for you? You know, all of those things combine. And so to make it a self-supported race, you know, a very big part of that is the navigation, is making the decisions that suit you and what your riding's like. Which includes safety and taking responsibility for your safety. Telling people to stop for 3 or 4 hours is very complex, and it's going to work for some people, it's not going to work for others. Obviously, you know, Adrian put that in his race, and we thought very seriously about it, you know, and we've considered it very, very carefully, and decided it's not the right thing for our race. But yeah, we definitely, everything that we can be doing to make the race as safe as possible, we, you know, it's very important to us, and we consider it all very carefully.
And just lastly, I mean, the EF Education First team have signed up with RAFA for next year. You know, RAFA, you know, this bikepacking movement is right up their street, as it is with other clothing companies and the equipment manufacturers. The whole you know, riding on gravel is you know, becoming so popular. Cycling is sort of subtly changing, and it's being led by events like the TCR in a certain way. It's really interesting to talk to Simon Mottram, the founder of RAFA. You know, has built that up from a small company into, you know, a multi-million pound enterprise. Interesting to hear him name checking the TCR as you know, something that has really captured his imagination. Whether or not an EF Education First rider will sign up for 2019, I don't know. But how would you feel as the organizer if somebody we recognize from the professional cycling world decided to take on the challenge? I mean, is that something that you kind of are aspiring to, or do you want to stay in the niche that you're kind of in?
Yeah, it's a really good question, and something that we're pondering. As you know, we don't really know. It's so exciting and really flattering that you know, that RAFA and these big names in cycling are interested and considering it. You know, it would be rude of us to, you know, that of course it is. It's really exciting. On the other hand, how's it going to change what we do and how the rest of our racers feel about what they do? I mean, it could be incredible, couldn't it, to pit some of our more experienced transcontinental racers against somebody who's used to supported racing, and actually see what happens. You know, it would be very interesting, the outcome of it, and you know, what would actually happen. You know, there's no way to know, is there? I guess we'll have to try it. So yeah we're flattered, but we're, I don't know.
Wait and see if it happens. You're not going to return an entry if it comes in.
No. You know, anybody's welcome to do the TCR, to do it on the TCR's terms, you know. And if they're prepared, I think it's pretty clear what we do, and if people want to enter on the terms of the TCR, then they're welcome. And I don't think it's a full conclusion what would happen if a pro racer entered the TCR. I think they don't, you know, the experience.
I think they'd really struggle.
Yeah.
I think a lot of them would really struggle. I think probably somebody like Lachlan Morton, who has, you know, done a lot of bike packing, might find it very interesting. I think it's possibly more likely that as companies get more interested, that the bike packing stars, if you like, James Hayden and so on, would become sort of, you know, mini teams associated, you know, riding in EF Education First kit. I mean, I'm purely speculating here, which I don't normally do about cycling, but it is really interesting. I wonder if you feel it's you said it's flattering, and but did it lend a kind of a legitimacy to what you're doing, and do you anticipate that it will you know, lead to another level? Is there another level?
Yeah, another good question. that again, yeah, and something that we consider as well. You know, we're at an interesting stage, I think, in what we do. There's a lot more attention on us now. What we used to do was run a super under the radar punky event that, you know, we didn't get a lot of attention for, and you know, that suited us. And now, you know, I wouldn't say we're the victims of our own success, but you know, there's a potential of sort of, now we're heading to different territory, and we've got to react to that, and we've got to make sure that we're doing what we're doing it in the right way, and we're reacting appropriately to, you know, to the changing nature of the event and people's expectations and everything of the event as well. So yes, new challenges for us.
I really appreciated Anna giving up some of her time to talk to Explore and helping me to understand what it was about Mike Hall's character that has influenced so many people. I know it wasn't an easy conversation for her at times, and so I'm very glad that we were able to just find out a bit more about Mike Hall, because the transcontinental race goes on, and very much in Mike Hall's image.
Yeah, and I think the way that she talks about how they chose to continue with the race that year, and because that's how Mike would have wanted it. And I totally agree. It's nice to be able to hear a little bit more about the man who, like you said, has influenced a lot of people. I mean, I know people who have used the hashtag Be More Mike quite a lot, and that kind of was done in his honour, as well as to continue the race. And yeah, I think it was quite an emotional, but it was a very positive interview about how great a person he was, with this insane ability to be able to just keep going and going and wanting to continuously explore and find new challenges. So it was good to hear that about him.
What's really interesting this year, recently the route for Transcontinental number 7, the 2019 event, has been unveiled, and whereas the previous events have all gone north to south, this one will go east to west. It will start on the coast of the Black Sea in Bulgaria, and it will finish in Brest in Brittany, at the tip of western France. And it seemed quite appropriate to go to Brest because that's the midpoint of the Paris-Brest-Paris race, which has been running since 1891. And 2019 is a Paris-Brest-Paris year as well. It's one of the sort of the most established of, I guess, the old school bike packing races, really. Perhaps the original of this kind of genre of cycling. And the race will kick off on Friday the 26th or Saturday the 27th. Of July 2019. There'll be four checkpoints, including one at the Paso Gardena and one at Alpe d'Huez. So it's taking the transcontinental riders to somewhere that I know very well from having covered the Tour de France, a real iconic climb of the Tour, Alpe d'Huez. And it just feels to me like these worlds continue to bump into one another.
Science in sport. Before you hit the wall, hit back.
Obviously, when you've come to the end of a stage, the hard work doesn't end there, and you think, right, okay, we're going to have a few beers to celebrate, you know, rehydrate the Flemish way. Hi, my name's Hayden Groves. I rode all three Grand Tours last year in 2017. Yeah, that's the Giro d'Italia, Tour de France, and Vuelta a España. Total distance of just over 10,400 kilometres. Not only did I do that, I'm also an ambassador for Science in Sport. And at the same time, I raised over £100,000 for the charity Cure Leukemia. So you've got about 20, 25 minutes post-exercise where your body is screaming out for carbs and protein. And so it would always be that sort of classic Rego recovery shake, straight in, straight down, and really kickstart the recovery process. And I didn't even chance any deviating from that, and I really helped with muscle soreness as well.
Thank you very much to Science in Sport for sponsoring this series of Explore, and indeed everything we've done this year. Anyone listening to the podcast can get 25% off all Science in Sport products by going to scienceinsport.com, filling up their shopping basket, and then when you check out, enter the code SISCP25. Thank you very much also to Hayden Groves, who has recorded this little mini series of nutrition tips as Explore has unfolded. I found it fascinating because Hayden is by profession a chef and so a man after my own heart, really. I followed his recipe for cassoulet last year, and excellent it was too. But it's, what's been really interesting is the marriage between, you know, real food and the nutritional supplements, energy drinks and bars and gels, and the fact that they complement one another, and you need both. And something that I probably wouldn't have appreciated a while ago, I'd have been a bit old school about things and thought, I don't need an energy drink, I'll just have some water. But even on my ride with Ned, I made sure that I had an electrolyte drink because it was an extremely hot couple of days and I didn't want to get dehydrated and you know, back myself into a corner, so to speak.
My question to you, Lionel, is have they managed to make you a cassoulet flavoured gel yet?
Once again, Hannah, my not so subtle hints in the podcast have fallen upon deaf ears, although I do accept that a cassoulet flavoured... But surely a cassoulet-flavoured gel is going to be quite a hard thing to replicate. I'm sure they could do it, but I'm not sure whether there'd be the demand, would there?
I mean, who knows? It could take off. I mean, it's going to definitely have some protein in there, that's for sure. So it will aid recovery.
It is. Well, it's got everything, hasn't it? Duck, sausage, beans. It's got all the right stuff that you need. So yeah, protein, carbs, yeah, why not? Over to the nutritionist at Science in Sport for that one. But you know, so far I've heard no whispers on the horizon that a cassoulet gel is coming. In the final part of this episode, we are thinking about the mammoth task of riding around the world. Quite an extraordinary achievement, really, just to contemplate. And in fact, Mike Hall did ride around the world and for a period held the record, was quickest around the world, but then the Guinness Book of Records have redefined what the record actually is since then. And so, you know, this record is becoming something that is much more clearly defined. There are some set rules if you want to try and break that record, and who better to find out about all of that from than Tom Whalley, who is in his shed.
Thank you, Lionel. Now, obviously, we're talking about the round the world record, the round the world cycling record, I should say, in a minute. And before we got onto that, I just wanted to fill you in on a few of the rules that govern that record. Now, the rules state that the journey should be continuous and in one direction. So that's from east to west or west to east, obviously. Now, both of the current record holders, Mark Beaumont and Jenny Graham, who are both Scottish, by the way, we're about to hear from them both, and they followed a similar route in their attempts. In fact, it was Mark's route, actually, that Jenny followed, pretty much. Now, the Guinness Book of World Records states that the minimum distance ridden should be 18,000 miles or 29,000 kilometres. Now, the route, it must be ridden through two approximate antipodal points. That is, points on the opposite sides of the Earth. So, for instance, Christchurch, the opposite side of the Earth to Christchurch is A Coruña in Spain. So if you are planning a route, I'd suggest you use antipodesmap.com. I've just put in my current coordinates, and the antipodal point for me would be somewhere in the ocean just south of New Zealand currently. Now, obviously, this causes some problems when you're planning routes. For example, the antipodes of Australia is spread out over the Atlantic Ocean, North America over the Indian Ocean, and Africa over the Mid-Pacific Ocean. So your choices are slightly limited when it comes to planning routes, which is why, obviously, people tend to choose a slightly similar route. Now, one thing the rules do not distinguish between are supported and unsupported rides. And as we'll hear, of the current two records, the men's and the women's, one was supported and the other was totally unsupported. The original record for Around the World Cycling was set in 1981. That was by Nick Sanders. He did 13,609 miles around the Northern Hemisphere in 138 days. 18 records have been set by both men and women, and notable record holders have included someone called Steve Strange, but pretty sure it's not that one, and Mike Hall, who we've just been hearing about, who set his record in 2012. He completed his circumnavigation in 91 days and 18 hours. His ride, typical of Mike, was totally unsupported. Now, after the ride, the Guinness World Records changed the rules to include total travel time. And under those new rules, Hall recorded a time of 107 days, 2 hours and 30 minutes, which was not actually ratified by the Guinness World Records. And the most recent successful attempt concluded on October of this year, 2018, in Berlin. And it was by Jenny Graham, who we're about to hear from.
Thank you very much, Tom. Riding round the world at least 29,000 kilometres, that is another level of challenge.
Yeah, it's absolutely, it's just a bit mind-boggling, isn't it, really? The thought of trying to even get to a start line with that ahead of you is quite crazy, especially if you're doing it unsupported as well, I think. And it is quite interesting how the records have been redefined, which I can imagine to people who then their record no longer stands. That must be absolutely gutting, absolutely gutting.
Well, yeah, but there's no distinction in the record books between supported and unsupported rides. So it just, how quickly can you get round the world on two wheels without, with or without support? Mark Beaumont's record was a supported, fully supported record, and Jenny Graham did it completely unsupported. And I'm sure at some point a woman will try and break that record, perhaps with a support crew. But Richard Moore spoke to Mark Beaumont and I spoke to Jenny Graham, and I started by asking how it was that she got to the point where she thought she could ride around the world.
So I have been riding for much longer than 5 years, but I'd only been competing for 5 years. So I'd only been, I only did my first mountain bike race 5 years ago. And it was at that point that I started building up my endurance and building up my miles. Before that, class that as like my normal rider years, where I would go out maybe once a week. But it was only in the last 5 years that I got serious about it and put all my sort of time and effort and money into it. Yeah. I'd started doing endurance events and realised that I was actually pretty good at the endurance side of things. So the whole sort of staying up, riding through the night, going day after day, so not necessarily going very quickly, but going, but carrying on and keeping going. I sort of discovered that actually I could do that, and I really enjoyed that. So that made me sort of question how many hours I could stay up for or how many miles I could do within that hour. So over that 5 years, there was a sort of step-by-step progression. If I look back and see the races that I did and things, and just the riding that I was doing, step-by-step progression of getting longer and longer and quicker at the same time. And it got to a point that I was, you know, I'd ridden sort of 250 miles, and then I got up the next day and I rode like another 200 miles, and then the day after that I came into work and I thought, oh boy, like if I can do that sort of mileage, then like I wonder what else I can do, like I wonder how long I could keep that going for. And so it was just that sort of questioning, wonder what I'm capable of, I wonder, yeah, how many miles I could cycle, that sort of spurred me on. It's actually what got me into road biking. So I got a road bike so as I could train for my mountain biking, and then just became addicted to the miles that I could get when I was out on the road compared to the mountain bike. So so that was going on in my head, and my son had grown up and he'd left school and he was working, so I no longer had that sort of financial need to work as much as I had been full time. So I decided to go part time at work and put more effort into riding again, not for anything in particular, but just out of curiosity and just because I loved it so much. And so I was doing that, and then I went away on this training camp with the Adventure Syndicate in Spain. So this was only like a year and a half ago. And I went away on that training camp and met like some amazing people, the most amazing women ever. But on that camp was a coach called John Hampshire. And after I spoke to him for a week, and I'd, you know, never had a coach before. So I was like loving, I was booking him with as many sessions as I could with him, and just, you know, going through all my plans and what sort of thing, like what would be the best thing for me to do for them. And after that trip, he contacted me through email and said, look, I'd like to work with you for a year. I know you know you can't afford it, and this will be for free, and we'll just see, he was doing an experiment to see what people would be capable of if they were given the right sort of opportunities. as soon as that happened in January, I was just in my head, I felt like, yes, this is a golden opportunity. This stuff doesn't just happen. You know, I'd already made that commitment by not pursuing a career at my work and you know, going part-time. And I knew that cycling or being in the mountains and endurance stuff was my passion. So, when that happened, I just had a feeling inside that I had to do something big with it and make the most of this opportunity. And so I went away. That was in the January, and I had a race in Arizona in the April, and it was when I was recovering from that race. So that's when all good plans start getting hatched. It's like, you know, usually in the pub and after a big ride. So I was recovering and looking at what other things I could be doing. So yeah, that's how that came about. And I was looking at a lot of mountain bike races mostly, and but then the round the world record, I'd spotted that, and I looked at the miles that I'd need for, you know, to break the record, and I thought, actually, I'm kind of doing that now. Yeah, I'm not doing it day after day, but I'm doing it now. I'm already doing that mile, so I wonder if I could, you know, do that day after day. So I work in an education social work department for the Highland Council, and I'm a children's service worker, and I've been here for 11 years. So they have seen the progression. It wasn't one day I woke up and started and came in after riding 200 miles, you know. It wasn't like that, and I've worked with them. They've seen my whole journey, if you like. So by the time that I was coming in after doing 250 miles back to back, it wasn't out of the blue. I mean, they were just like, oh yeah, of course you did, because they know, like, that's what I do anyway. So that stuff's not a major surprise to them. But their reaction when I said I was going around the world, I mean, it's a bit of a blurry time. I can't quite remember. I don't think I told them as a group. I think I told them individually, because at the time that I was saying it out loud, then I was really struggling with saying it out loud, you know, because I had so many sort of, it was just so scary, like, putting yourself out there to be judged and to fail, and, you know, like, just, you're putting yourself out and you're saying, I am good enough to do this, and it's really difficult. Like, I struggle doing that, sort of, you know, admitting that I think I might be good enough to do something this big. Then yeah, that was major for me. So I think I told everybody individually, because I probably couldn't handle people's reaction if I told them in one go. So the bit I was surprised me the most whilst on the road was actually how much I enjoyed it, being out there. I mean, I was always really looking forward to going and, you know, having the challenge, but I thought I would struggle more mentally than I actually did when I was out there. It surprised me when I was on the road that I didn't get lonely, that I didn't ever, like, not once think I don't want to go any further, or I'm quitting, or I can't do this. Like, the thought never even crossed my mind. And even through the, like, I was surprised at maybe how much I laughed and how much I was able to keep from going too dark or too negative if it was a tricky time, if it was bad weather, or if it was, you know, if I was really tired, then it's quite easy to let your brain, like, go into this negative cycle. But actually, yeah, I surprised myself at how well I managed that, to keep control of that out there. So when I decided in the April I was going to do this, and then I said it, first time I said it out loud was on the way to another race, the Highland Trail 550, and in that conversation, my friend told me, well, you know, Mark Bowman is going to do that this year. He's trying to do it in 80 days. So, and he's going to go public about it this weekend. I thought, no, I didn't know that. Like, I hadn't heard that. And I was a little bit, at the time, I was like, oh no, I'll never get funding, you know, because I'm not trying to do it as fast as him and all this sort of stuff. He was obviously doing it supported, and but then the more I thought about it, the more I was like, well, this could really help, because Mark has got an amazing team behind him and, you know, really good sponsors, and he's obviously trying to do it in 80 days, so there's going to be a lot of work gone into his route. So I looked at his route, and then I looked at the route that I would like to take, and I just, like, tore them apart and just... yeah, just made a decision on, well, should I follow Mark's route or should I follow my route? And the main difference, I mean, there's parts of the world that you haven't really got a choice. You know, when you're going over to Australia, I mean, there is a choice, but there's a... there's a really straightforward way of getting the miles, like the easiest miles for the longest distance. So there's places like that that's standard. But going through Russia, I would never have done. I would have come down and gone through the stands and into India, which was the way that I really wanted to do. And I was looking into it so much. And then I spoke to Mark about it and said, you know, that I was planning it and the route. I was like thinking about the route. And he sort of pointed out his team and him had put 2 years planning into finding the fastest route around the world. And I thought, yeah, if I'm going for the record, I really need to follow that route because I've definitely not got the resources to put that amount of effort into planning the route. So, yeah, so I knew by following his route that it would be quicker. So that's what I did in the end. Mostly followed Mark's route. I had to make a few adjustments because I was, you know, self-supported and he was supported. So I took way more detours and had to go and find supplies and things like that. But yeah, the base of the route was Mark's.
Mark, what is it about Scottish people and round the world records?
I know. Pretty proud. I've got Jenny coming home with another new world record, and for a small nation, we've taken on the world again and triumphed. So yeah, when Jenny first came to me with the ambition to take the female record, you know, I was inspired by her, you know, ambition, and I was flattered to see that she followed my route almost exactly, and she nailed it. I had a FaceTime when she was in Germany just after the finish, and I know what that feels like in the aftermath. She looked a bit shell-shocked, a bit rabbits in the headlights with all the press reaction and the excitement. I mean, without any prior experience to what that's like, you go out there with a simple ambition to ride your bike. I remember what it's like. You finish and suddenly the world's eyes are on you, and all you want to do is sleep for Scotland. So I was in touch quite a lot in the build-up, just helping with bits and bobs, and then we messaged, you know, during the ride. But it was absolutely lovely to have a call, and you know, for my kids to say hi and to see the excitement at the finish.
I don't think I avoided the dark times. There was definitely dark times there, but I think I managed to recognise the dark times and take ownership back of them, if you like. If I needed to let out emotion, if anything happened and I was upset, or, you know, if anything happened and I was, you know, whatever emotion I felt, like I allowed myself to feel it, and it was just coming back out of that I worked on. I mean, I had lots in my toolbox in terms of things I could listen to, so like music or podcasts or audiobooks. I also had like sort of games that I would play with myself if I was counting games, sort of making deals with yourself, you know, to get yourself up in the morning. It would be like, right, coffee was my friend out there. Like, caffeine was just like what I craved the whole time, and so I would make deals with myself about how many coffees I could have day just to get me out of my bed. So I would do lots of that kind of if you just get out of your bed now, you can stay for two coffees when you get to the cafe, and be like, right, okay, that's what I'll do. And quite often I never stayed for the 8 coffees, or I never stayed for that treats that I'd promised myself, but it was enough to get out of my bed in the morning. I think my average speed was around 21 kilometres an hour, maybe 22 kilometres an hour. So you're riding through places and you're taking it all in, but then you're stopping and getting food and finding accommodation, or finding, like, chatting to people about safe places to camp. And yeah, so I felt like I was taking it in, but I felt like, you know, I was aware that it was snapshots that I was getting from places, but I really loved that. I really loved the having these, like, gorgeous, like, interactions with people, and you know, often really kind interactions, and then leaving again and having a purpose that I was, you know, leaving for, but just being left with an image of a place that was all sort of based around this interaction that I'd had. I mean, there was major language barriers as well, but also just the culture and the, you know, poverty in places going across Asia. I felt so rich, like not only for what I was riding and what I was dressed in, but actually having the choice to not be working and not to be, you know, to take this time off and to get sponsors behind me to give me this money to do this amazing thing. It was like, oh yeah. So there was places that I couldn't get into. It would have been too big. It was too much for them to sort of comprehend. So I would say things like for example, when I was going across Russia and Siberia, then I would say, oh yeah, I'm going from Moscow to Mongolia, because that people could picture that. People had, that was still a massive journey for them, but they understood that I was on a journey, you know, and I was Westerner that was on this journey from places to places that they knew on by bike. And this blew their mind, me just saying that. So let alone me saying that I was actually cycling around the world.
Did you ever feel vulnerable? I mean, it's striking me as I'm kind of half asking this question. I wouldn't have asked, not that I didn't do our interview with Mark Beaumont, but I wouldn't have, and I know he was supported as well, but he has ridden unsupported as well. It wouldn't necessarily occur to ask a man if they felt vulnerable. But I just trying to visualise what you did. I'm not sure I could sleep out in a bivy bag two nights out of three on average for 124 nights. It's not something that I would want to do, and I would be frightened as well in cycling alone through parts of the world. And I just wonder, did you feel vulnerable? Did the fact that you're a woman make it feel any different? I know that's you probably can't, you know, no one can really answer because they don't know what it's like to be the other gender, I guess. But in my slightly ham-fisted way, I mean, did you feel, you know, vulnerable at any points?
Yeah, I always wonder if Mark gets asked these questions as well, because I had a lot of messages. I had a lot of people saying these things to me, like, you're so brave, I could never do that, I could, you know, and like, yeah, messaging me out there, just like bravery came up a lot, and I just couldn't understand it, because I thought, I'm not being brave because I'm not scared. Like, you can only be brave surely if you're scared of something and you have to fight through that. So I didn't feel like when I was out on the road that I was like scared of the people or scared of being in foreign places. But then I looked at my journey to actually get to the start line, and I mean, I didn't just roll out of bed and decide to do this. I had been building this up for years, and even before my biking background, I'd been used to going away on expeds either alone or with friends into the hills and being self-sufficient. So I'd sort of ticked that off, and I'd already travelled by bike by myself in different places in Europe, so I knew what that part would feel like, and that was another sort of big part of it. So I had a moment in Russia where the traffic on the Trans-Siberian Highway was just crazy. There was no space for cyclists to be there, and there was big, huge trucks, and it was so dangerous. And I came off the road. I mean, I was coming off the road all the time, like jumping into verges and just to get out of the way of the traffic that was coming towards me. And at that point, I mean, I was not only scared, but I felt really stupid for being there. Like, it was only 8 or 9 days into this journey, and I thought, I could mess this all up, you know, why am I here? So at that point, then that's when I changed and started cycling at night instead of cycling through the day. So I still had a little bit of riding through the day, but I got my sort of 14 hours by riding on through the night until 8 in the morning. So it was only getting busy when I was going to bed. And I did that to get out of, I mean, it was only busy for maybe 1500 miles. So I just had to do that for maybe 5 days and get, or 1500 kilometers, sorry, in just 5 days and get out of the busy bit. And then, yeah, and the bears. So I was really scared of the kangaroos when I was in Australia, but there was no snakes because it was winter. So there was no snakes or spiders about. And it was really, really bad weather too. So there was like, yeah, they were all hidden away. But the bears, when I got to Alaska, I was fairly scared then. But I had, I think at that point I could rationalise it because it was like, you are actually really tired. Like I was speaking to myself saying, you're actually just really, really tired. And anything above and beyond sort of just riding the smiles and looking after you is... is turning into a bigger deal. So I managed to sort of, yeah, rationalise that and just do everything I could to make myself noisy on the road. And yeah,
well, the first task after the world was to just decompress. I mean, I can't put into words what it was like to come back after 78 days racing 18,000 miles, you know, having averaged 240 miles a day, and physically, but more importantly mentally, you know, what that roller coaster was like for the first 2-3 months when I was home. I mean, finding just a different normality, you know, I'd put myself under so much stress out there, sleep deprivation and the rest of it. So I had to straighten out, you know. I think around the time I was talking to you, I went for a DEXA scan. My bone density was down because I'd not been weight bearing for 2.5 months. I'd been time trialing for 1200 hours on the saddle. So I needed to straighten out my body, normalize my fitness, and that took months. But then the psychology of coming back from a trip like that again took a while. And you're sort of expected to live on cloud nine. You're expected to just be, but I'm sure you've heard this from Olympians and Commonwealth athletes the same. When you complete the big milestone event, whether you succeed or fail, there's a real void. Doesn't matter how busy you are, you don't have that simple clarity and that routine of training and purpose and racing. And so I came off the back of the world and I was in the world's media and it was nuts for months. But I wasn't the happiest man because, you know, it took a while to just sort of decompress. And I think that's a bit of an honest truth here that maybe a lot of athletes don't talk about. You know, I'd taken on my Everest, I'd taken on my biggest dream as an athlete, I'd got around the world in 80 days, but yeah, you don't, I wasn't euphoric about it. It took a while to get a bit of perspective on it and just to, which sounds slightly ungrateful, which isn't the case. I just think the psychology of putting yourself through something like that is quite interesting. And then the honest truth of what it feels like afterwards.
So, I mean, it feels incredible, first of all, just to have had that ambition, to have fought through all that, like, moments of doubt that I wasn't good enough to put myself out there and I wasn't, you know, the type of person that could do this. And then to have gone and done it, I felt amazing just getting to the start line, because that was definitely the hardest part of the trip. But yeah, so that feels great. And in terms of taking the time off, I mean, Guinness don't differentiate between self-supported and supported. I mean, I reckon people could go out and do it self-supported and shave a lot of time off it. So I'm under no illusion that that'll get done, and I hope it does. I mean, there's only I'm only the third woman to have tried it. You know, there's another woman out there doing it just now. I think sort of breaking down that barriers for females, that whole thing of that you just asked me, would I be, you know, was I scared on the road, and you didn't think you'd ask Mark that. I mean, that isn't just you, that is people, that's our perception, isn't it? So if I can be a role model for women, other women, to say, well, actually, what am I scared of out there? You know, why is this for other people, or why is this for men, or anything like that, then yeah, the more women out there trying to smash it, the better, I think.
Adventure cycling has come a long way towards road racing, insofar as, you know, 10 years ago it was still 5-bag touring, whereas now, you know, all the serious guys and girls who are out there doing big distances are ultimately racing road race bikes, even if they are going unsupported, with minimal kit. I mean, the minimalist approach is far more akin to road racing than touring. But the distances that guys and girls are laying down the athleticism of it, as opposed to simply the wild man adventure. It's no longer just about, you know, where are you pitching your tent and where's your next meal. These are serious distances that people are laying down, and the physicality and the psychology to do that is definitely. And I think the exciting thing about ultra endurance is almost anyone can do it. You know, if you don't have that top end power and speed, you can still ride distance. When I came back last year and they put the story for the Around the World in 80 Days on the front cover of Cycling Weekly, I suddenly realised that, you know, ultra endurance was now, you know, going mainstream. You know, that would have never happened 5 years ago. But there's that interest and the engagement from, you know, your average roadie now is considerable. But I think there's more and more people interested in riding endurance and a lot more respect. You know, I've had a number of pro cyclists join me for these 200 plus mile days, and you know, it's not what you expect. It's not all about how fast is your 10 mile TT. You know, if you can suffer a double century, if you can ride a 400 kilometer route, you know, the physicality and the psychology on the bike is pretty interesting.
It's funny, when I was riding, I was like, do you know what? I would never do this supported. I think when you're absolutely run down and exhausted, then you can never imagine doing it. I mean, supported things isn't where I don't get a buzz. It's not where my passion lies, I suppose, doing things supported. You know, I get a great buzz out of doing things and supported and having that different challenge. So it's not something that I'm dying to get going or it's not in my sights anyway. But I mean, never say never. I don't think I would put all my energy into finding sponsors and planning that to do a supported run. I'd much rather do an unsupported off-road round the world than I would a supported on the road again.
The interest in all things adventure, ultra, is grown hugely, specifically when it comes to the extremes of the around the world. When I first broke the record in 2007-2008, people immediately set their sights on that and said, right, well, we can beat that. And rightly so, when I did it 194 days. And every single year, people went for the record. We've now got over a year's space between when I finished at the Arc de Triomphe in Paris, and nobody has put their hand up and said they want to break the circumnavigation. The Around the World record should be as professional and as coveted as the Around the World sailing record. Think of the scale of the sport of cycling. It's the world. It's the ultimate. It's the ultimate endurance accolade out there. And I'm very proud to have been part of the generation that have, you know, given it that kudos. But there's nobody yet put their hand up and said they're going to go faster than 78 days, 14 hours, 40 minutes. So I hope they do. I hope it happens soon. The reality, the tough reality with the circumnavigation is, it's not just about being a good endurance bike rider. You need to be able to, you know, approach this professionally, put a great support team behind you, have the logistics, finance it. I can think of I always say this, I'm 6'3" and 90 kilos. I'm definitely not the world's best bike rider. But, you know, I've managed to build the project, build the ability to even give myself a shot of this. And the 80 days was a big prize. The 80 days was a bit of a one-time prize. So if you go back to break the record now, to convince a sponsor to give you £500,000 or whatever it will take you is a difficult, different proposition than the one I had. And the margin is less. You know, I broke the previous record by 37%. You're not going to do that again. So I want people to go for the record. There's other big endurance races out there. I mean, we just saw the Pan America's record fall, which is Alaska down to Tierra del Fuego. The third big record out there in terms of ultra endurance in my book is the Caro to Cape Town, which is a record I still hold, but I think that's prime for the taking, because when I rode it, there was still 800 kilometres of dirt road in southern Ethiopia and northern Kenya. As of last year, there's pretty much tarmac all the way, and there's a more direct route through Tanzania. So even if you take those three big ultra routes, the circumnavigation, the Pan Americas, and the Caro to Cape Town, the length of Africa, that crisscrosses the inhabited continents of the world pretty well. The Africa record is probably the simplest to break. You could definitely go sub 40 days now. That record is definitely prime for the taking, because simply because the routes got faster. And with due respect to what happened a couple of weeks ago with Michael Strasser, you could definitely go faster down the Americas. It's still not at the same distances we were laying down for the Around the World. But the big prize is the circumnavigation. Obviously, I'm biased, but I would love to see somebody step up and give that a crack.
Well, Hannah, this series of Explore has turned out to be a bit like a bikepacking trip where we've got our pacing all wrong. We're having to add an extra episode or an extra day on at the end.
I know. Can you imagine if they did that to the Transcontinental race? Said, sorry, we're going to add an extra stage on. Or to the Tour de France, it's not going to be 21 days. It's going to be now 22. I think we're doing very well. We've shown true endurance in this series.
Oh, I hope it hasn't felt like an endurance event recording Explore.
But in like the words of James Hayden, it wasn't type 2 fun. It's definitely type 1 fun, Lionel, so don't you worry.
Oh, that's very, very reassuring. Well, we will be back. We will be back on New Year's Day with, quite a mixed bag of interviews and a bit of chat with Richard Moore as well about how this whole world of bikepacking is evolving and how it's going to perhaps dovetail a bit more with the world of professional cycling. And that will be out on January the 1st, New Year's Day. And until then, I guess that's it, Hannah.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
I'll be seeing you in the Festive 500 at Simon's Cafe, ready for a ride.
Next time on Explore.
I mean, we have an interesting thing at Rafa because we're inspired by racing, but actually what we do is riding. And so it's kind of, is it road cycling or road racing? And for a long time, it's been difficult because they've been getting further away, as we said. I think racing is at its best when it's got a direct line to riding.
You have been listening to Explore by the Cycling Podcast. The producer was Tom Wally. Music in this episode, including our opening theme, Beyond the Black Veil, is by Moscow Youth Cult. Their latest album, Brutalist, is out now on Hello Thor Records. You can find it via hellothor.bandcamp.com. This episode also featured additional music by John Dix.